Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmondo, aka Adam Richmond, in case you think my name's Adam Richmondo. It's not, it's Adam Richmond. This is the show in which we talk about the movies or films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. I do that always, 'twas ever thus, with me old co-host, Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello there, how's it going?
Yeah, pretty good, as discussed.
Right,
we've already sorted all that. On today's show, we are doing the 2002 Doug Liman directed flick, The Bourne Identity. Yeah. It's 119 mins, guys. This flick is 10 mins too long, with a script from Tony Gilroy. Very important. Very important. It was written by Tony Gilroy. Based on the book of the same name, The Bourne Identity. Yeah, The Bourne Identity. And here is to the letterbox. Actually, do you know what? I watched this on DVD.
Did you?
Because it lives in the house.
Oh, that it's the Westcott DVD, of course. You've got quite a good DVD selection there in the house, haven't you?
It's got Supremacy.
Wow.
It's got Ultimatum. It's got some old Nolans that I've gifted to the house because I've traded up onto the Blu-rays. Memento lives here because of me, because I've got Memento on Blu-ray.
It's a little holiday gift to yourself, I would say. Gifted to the house is a quite grandiose term. No one else there is watching Memento, let's be honest.
A new movie experience with an all-new beginning and ending. That's what the DVD says. I had to check whether I should watch the all-new beginning and ending.
What?
And the internet said, don't do that.
Well, hang on, sorry. The DVD version has an all-new beginning and ending to the feature film that was released in cinemas.
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
I can get into that if you want.
No, actually, I'll take the question back. You didn't watch it then?
Absolutely not.
Fair enough.
I double-checked. But we've got exclusive, never-before-seen special features. Academy Award winner Matt Damon stars in the explosive, action-packed hit filled with incredible fight sequences. Found with two bullets in his back, Jason Bourne discovers he has skills of a very dangerous man and no memory of his violent past. Racing to unlock the secret of his own identity, he discovers the deadly truth. He's an elite government agent, a $30 million weapon the government no longer trusts. Now, this top operative in the government's number one target in this supercharged thriller minute spectacular that is a rollicking blockbuster ride, Empire.
Wow.
And then it's got various options and bonuses. Matt Damon, from Identity to Supremacy, deleted scenes, inside a fight scene,
cloak and dagger. Hey, question.
The Bourne, he'll never let me finish the bonuses.
Just a quick question. You know how Jason Bourne wakes up, doesn't know who he is, and slowly starts to discover things about himself? And that, you know, the best scene for that is when he's trying to sleep on the German bench. He's just having a nice German sleep on the cold, snowy German bench. And what do the German police do? They come along and they say, hey, you can't sleep here, because it says there's signs that say you can't sleep here. And he says, listen, I'm tired. But then all of a sudden, he just, without knowing how, he stands up, he beats the shit out of them, and he steals their gun. You know? It's a fun scene. Very impressive score. And I love that little fight scene because there's a little twist of delight in the scene where he ends the scene having floored the two police officers by holding a gun. And you never see where he gets the gun. You never see how he takes the gun off one of the police. So you're establishing this fabulous superhero. Anyway, that caused me pause for thought. I thought, well, now, if you or I had amnesia and we couldn't remember who we were, and we were rediscovering ourselves through our skills, what do you think, like, would be the skills that you have that, you know, your sort of logic brain would remember, even if your short-term memory brain couldn't?
It's a great question, because that is the heart of The Bourne Identity, and that's what Tony Gilroy, the screenwriter of The Bourne Identity and the latter two, Supremacy and Ultimatums, saw within Robert Ludlum's novel, which is quite different from the screenplay. He realized that this amnesia plot, the juice of it is like a man who's forgotten who he is has to rediscover who he is by what he can do. The realization is, I can do all these horrible things And by doing those, he realizes that he used to be this horrible man.
Yeah.
And so I think that would be the same for you and me.
But we'd realize that we were horrible.
Yeah, we would slowly, we'd be this tabula rasas, and we'd think, oh, we're okay. And then slowly we would do those things like, oh, I'd correct someone's grammar. Someone would say, oh, you can't spit an infinitive. And I'd say, excuse me, I think you can, actually. I think that's outdated.
Right.
And I'd go, wait, what? How did I know that?
Right. And what would I do?
And you would say, I think your just whole vibe would just come through.
Right.
You'd always just try to dominate someone.
People wouldn't know that I'd forgotten. Because, like, I basically have forgotten anyway.
Exactly. No one's going to know. Like, you'd wake up the same, and I wouldn't even know that you'd forgotten who you are. You'd be on this podcast, and
you wouldn't
as
know.
Far as I'm concerned, you've been born already.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello. Who's this?
It's Adam.
Adam. Okay.
So, Joe, it's Adam.
Oh.
Why are you asking me who this is?
What did you call me?
Joe. You're Joe. You come through on my phone as Joe.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, do you know what? I found this phone, and I was just calling back the last number that I had dialed on it, or that had been dialed on it, because I can't remember who I am or anything about my life. So I thought maybe the person who I called last would be able to help me remember who I was.
You're Joe, because you sound like Joe. So you're Joe. You're Mr. Joe Devine.
What can you tell me about? Can you tell me about me to help me remember myself?
Well, you like to make silly phone calls, for starters.
So this is quite confusing, then.
Well, this is very in character.
Right. Okay.
Not confusing for me.
It's expected.
I'm not confused.
The kind of thing that would happen if I hadn't forgotten everything.
Right.
Could be quite confusing if other people were listening.
Who would be listening, though?
I don't know. Listen, I remember watching The Bourne Identity years ago, and I thought when I couldn't remember who I was, I wondered, is it possible that, you know, but it doesn't seem like I am a superhero.
You've woken up, you've lost your memory, but you remember the film The Bourne Identity.
What's weird is that I remember a lot about cinema. I remember, I think, almost every film I've ever seen, but I don't remember anything about myself.
Well, you might think that people are listening because we do a podcast together. So people
do
actually listen, in a way. Yeah.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's, what's it called?
The Movies You Forgot podcast.
No, it's not. Is it?
It's about memory.
Oh, no. So this is really appropriate.
You would think for someone who has lost their memory, let me ask you this, another, like, you would love all movies about memory and losing memory. Let me ask you this, like,
Yeah.
Instantly, you'll know, knee-jerk.
Yeah.
Do you like the movie Memento?
I don't like the movie Memento, no.
Right, so you just know that, right?
I just know that, yeah. I do know that. Now, does that inform me much about my own character?
I would say that's 90% of your character is your feelings towards Memento. And and everything else is kind of decoration.
Wow. Well, this was a great phone call then, because I'm 90% back to who I was before. That's pretty good. It's all coming back to me now. Yeah, it's a small film with no scope or scale. I remember. It's just boring. Oh, let's watch a man read tattoos off his own legs over and over again. Yeah. That's true.
Wow, it's just all in there, isn't it?
It's like, flooded back. It's flooded back. That's right.
Let me say something to you.
Mm-hmm.
A wizard is never late, Mr. Frodo. A wizard arrives exactly when he means to.
It's precisely when he means to. Very good. Now,
See, I got that deliberately wrong, and you know.
Can I tell you something I found out today, actually? This was the first thing I read after I woke up with amnesia, obviously.
Right.
But it wouldn't make sense if I didn't do it in the course of this conversation. But I found out that either New Line Cinema or Peter Jackson, I'm not really sure who, desperately tried to get Sean Connery to play Gandalf and offered him many millions, but also offered him 15% of the global box office of Lord of the Rings in order to do it. And he read the script and he just said, I just don't get it, and didn't like it, and then didn't want to do it. Which I, for one, I'm absolutely delighted at, because Ian McKellen was the Oscar winner. In terms of acting performances from The Lord of the Rings. And I cannot imagine Lord of the Rings with Sean Connery as Gandalf. Can you imagine that?
Well, can I surprise you, Joe?
Yeah.
Like everything, you don't know me because you can't really remember me, but can I surprise you?
I'm sort of getting a sense of who you are, though, to be honest. It's pretty clear. Yeah.
I already knew that.
Did you?
Yeah. I remember reading it in the trades at the time about 20 years ago. So you telling that to me is it's very much a busman's holiday.
Got it.
And I would love to have seen Sean Connery in those movies. They would have made them.
Would you really?
1,000
Wow, you really going to say they would have made 1,000 times better? Is that what you're going to say?
They would make 1,000.
A wizard has never wait, Mr. Frodo. A wizard arrives precisely when they meant to.
Run, you fools.
Yeah, fly, you fools. I'm going to go down
Connery changes the line. Peter, in the script it says, fly, you fools. But these hobbits, they don't have wings, Peter. They've got legs. So I think I'm going to have to read it as run, you fools, okay?
Hairy little legs.
Well, okay, yes, that's right. I am James Bond. Okay, here we go, Peter. Do the take.
Anyway, listen, man, I got to go. Because I'm pretty sure I got other stuff going on. But this has been great. Thanks for good to get to know you a little bit. And I feel like I've got a really clear sense of who you are. So much appreciated. All the best. And I'll speak to you again soon, Dan. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye. It's a bit outrageous that we're doing the Bourne Identity on the Movies You Forgot podcast, because I haven't watched this movie in 20 years. I don't think about Bourne ever. I only really ever rewatched Supremacy and Ultimatum, and I had pretty much forgotten this flick.
Let's just dig into that just momentarily, because I don't know that there's another person alive that rewatches the Bourne Supremacy and the Bourne Ultimatum, but doesn't rewatch the Bourne Identity. How do you... I mean, explain yourself.
Well, because I grew up as a Bond boy, and so it was lovely to see the Bourne Identity, and I can appreciate what Doug Liman wanted to do. He thought the Bond was silly, and this was an absolute breath of fresh air when it hit cinemas in 2002, and I thought, this is great. I was at uni, maybe my last year, but I never, I kind of didn't rewatch it. But Supremacy and Ultimatum with Paul Greengrass, he stepped up the action, and I'm about action and the fights. Yeah. And so rewatching Identity, the action and the fights are fine. They're a little bit shit. You do get the pen in this bit. Bourne grabs a pen. So Bourne, they do establish the character. He can fight with whatever. But Greengrass, he's like, no, my Bourne, he grabs a fucking magazine. Right. This guy can grab a magazine. He can roll it up. And it's just sort of elevated it all.
It's not a huge evolution, though, is it, from pen to magazine? I mean, that, isn't the notion that this guy fights with unusual objects while his opponents are holding knives and guns? He's got first a biro, then a magazine, and then I think, a little bit of a bathroom sink or something in the third one.
Yes, but the way that Greengrass shoots it and cuts it is just a little bit punchier. It's just slightly better.
It's just slightly better. Because what you're saying does sound like sort of like ludicrous, It's like what you're saying is like, Paul Greengrass, right? He watched this movie. It was like the first one he was fighting with a pen, and Paul Greengrass came in and said, Do you know what? Don't fight with a pen. fight with a magazine. And that's just changed everything, you know?
He rolls up the magazine. It's that extra little bit of action.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then also when you read about, like, Tony Gilroy, who wrote the screenplay for this, he hated Doug Liman.
Right.
And he didn't like what Doug Liman did to his script. And everyone hated Doug Liman, you know, more broadly. Like, yeah. He had constant fights with the studios. He wanted to improvise more. He wanted more budget. But then a lot of the stuff that he wanted to do, like shooting on location, is a great benefit to the movie. Liman has this great... It's one of those rare American movies that is shot in Europe that feels like it belongs in Europe. It's very drab.
Yeah.
And just bog standard.
It feels almost like Eastern European, doesn't it? Because of the colour grading, yeah, and everything. It feels like it's behind the Iron Curtain or something.
Yeah, and so there's all lots of lovely stuff like that. But yeah, Tony Gilroy wasn't a fan of Liman's treatment of his screenplay, which he considered quite taut, and that he had lots of reversals in. And then he also thought that Doug Liman let Bourne off lightly. Like, Bourne basically gets away with the girl. He gets to be a murderer, and like, he gets off scot-free. And Tony Gilroy wanted Bourne to kind of pay a price for his past life, and which is why that's the kind of thrust of Supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they get rid of Liman and they bring in Greengrass, and he wanted a bit more depth to the character, which I think that's what the Supremacy and Ultimatum's about. And it's just I'm a writer guy. I'm into the writer. I'm into the story mechanics and the character mechanics.
Right.
Fair play, Liman. You've done something, but also, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, you haven't done a rolled up magazine.
Right.
You've just done a biro.
Yeah. Well, as ever, I don't know why I'm surprised. Obviously, it's the Bourne trilogy. I thought these movies are great. There's no way. There's nothing that we could have reverse opinions about. But unfortunately, we do. I love Supremacy and Ultimatum. But you see, my friend Paul and I, as part of our sort of semi-regular movie club chats, we did the Bourne Identity, the Bourne Supremacy, and the Bourne Ultimatum. We did the Bourne trilogy, basically. And we always score our movies out of 100. Okay. Now, these are our combined scores. We don't keep our individual scores because it's very much a sort of collective movie club group. But we have scored The Bourne Identity 94 out of 100.
Are you mad?
We love The Bourne Identity. We
94.
Love The Bourne Identity. 94 is one of the highest scores we've ever given. I'll tell you, there's a couple of films in the 90s. Of all the movies we've ever done. Oh, here's one. Past Lives has a very, very, very high score. That was 95. Oh, The Ballad of Wallace Island made it into the 90s. We loved that. My Neighbor Totoro, 97. So high. We're a very generous, friendly club. Anyway, it's not cynical like our podcast, right? We score films in the way that we feel about them. Now, here's the thing. The Bourne Identity has 94. The Bourne Supremacy has 94. The Bourne Ultimatum... 85. So for us, and my favourite of the movies is The Bourne Identity. I love it the most of all three. I'm a big fan of Bourne Supremacy as well. Bourne Ultimatum, I think, is a terrific film. It's a real achievement, but it isn't of the standard of the first two, in my opinion. There's something about it that's a little bit lacking, you know.
Yeah, it's there are problems with Ultimatum. Like, for example, they bring Albert Finney in as the Doctor.
Yes. Jason, come here, Jason. Do you remember who you are, boy? That's my Albert Finney impression.
It's great. He looks far too much like Brian Cox.
I know, it's confusing.
He's a pre-established character from Identity and Supremacy. It's like, you cannot do this. Yeah. Albert Finney is one of the finest actors of his generation of all time. I fucking love him.
It's like having Enzo Maresca replace Pep Guardiola as Man City manager. It's just not enough difference, you know? They look identical.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just can't do it.
No, you can't do it. You can't do it.
You know what it's like?
What's it like?
It's like, you know, swapping Garry Kasparov for...
Kasparov?
You know, Bill Kaparov. Kasparov for Kaparov.
Right.
Yeah, Kaparov.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
You just can't... Who's who?
You just can't do that, can you?
You just can't do it.
No. Do you know what it's like? It's like swapping out that guy who played Dario Naharis in the Game of Thrones at the end of that second season for the guy that played Dario Naharis in Game of Thrones from the beginning of the third season onwards. You just can't do it.
Yeah, no, it's just it's just not allowed. You know, it's just like bringing in J.J. Abrams for Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just not allowed. You know,
it's just pointless.
You know what it's like? It's like it's like trying to cast Sean Connery as Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings, right? It's just not allowed.
Yeah, you just wouldn't tell. You wouldn't know the difference, right? It's just like for like.
That's no. That's not what I was saying. I've actually misused the. I've got it confused.
It's a riddle. Speak, friend, and enter. What's the Elvish word for friend?
Man, I've seen a lot of films recently. I went to see The End of Oak Street the other day.
Mm.
Would you like to hear about that?
The most surprising thing I've ever heard this year is Mr. Joe Devine saying, I've seen The End of Oak Street, the most least likely movie you'd ever see. It's got Anne Hathaway in.
And no, that's not true, because it's because I like horror the least, so I wouldn't go and see a horror film.
Yeah, but this is like mainstream big budget Hollywood blockbuster. That's just not your cup of tea.
That's true.
You don't go and see this stuff.
There was nothing else on. I wanted to go and there was nothing else on.
Well, this is why I rate you as a human being.
Right.
Even when there's nothing on at the cinema, you go to the cinema. Never mind the movie.
Yeah, I
turn up at the cinema, and that's why you are in the top 1% of all human beings. Anyone who doesn't go to the cinema, there's nothing on, I won't go. Don't rate you.
There's always something on.
Find something. Go and see. Just see the thing. It's being at the cinema that counts.
I got a little kick out of the fact that my wife wanted to go. Well, she didn't want to go to see that film, but she was up for going to see the cinema. And I said, hey, Les, what about this film? You know, I sort of didn't tell her anything about it. Actually, I did. I told her that I'd heard someone say on TikTok that it was like a surprise great film of the year, you know? I'd also heard people on TikTok say it was the worst film of the year, but I didn't mention that until we sat down in the cinema just to like rebalance.
Oh, is that when you mentioned it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got her excited to go.
Oh, by the way, the film's about to start. Other people have also said this is possibly the biggest pieces of shit ever. Anyway, shut up, wife. The movie's starting.
That's it. That's exactly what I did. Because I take my job seriously with my wife. What I thought was, well, I'll get her excited about the cinema. Yeah, I'll get her frigging excited because she'll think, wow, this is a surprise best film of the year. And a strong year, a surprise best film of the year. And then that will make her want to go to the cinema. And then when we get there, it's my responsibility to dramatically lower her expectations just before the film starts in order that she enjoy the film. And I think if I hadn't done that, she might have been very disappointed, because I can tell you, it's not one of the best films of the year, but it is also not one of the worst films of the year. So it's absolutely fine, you know.
It looks absolutely pointless.
Yeah.
From the director of It Follows, you know, what are you doing?
You've got to say, though, very supportive of Hollywood making movies about dinosaurs that aren't in the sort of Jurassic Park or World franchise. They don't own dinosaurs. Other people are allowed to make dinosaur films. I was trying to think, was the last one... 65 million years ago with Adam Driver, was that it?
Just 65, they called it.
Just 65.
Imagine like this movie's called 65 million years ago. Do you want to go and see 65 million years ago? Yeah, let's go and see that. That's a weird name for a movie.
Wow, that's a better name than 65. That's so,
they call it 65. It comes up with 65 and then the million years ago comes up.
Oh.
It kind of fades in.
So it's kind of called 65 million years ago.
Kind of like what they've called it. But yeah, no, they've not, yeah.
Well, anyway, you know, I like dinosaurs, and I'm very happy when they make films with dinosaurs in. Having said that, I was reflecting on the dinosaurs in films and thinking, it's quite good, isn't it, that they made Jurassic Park before the scientific community learned that dinosaurs had feathers, because I'm a big fan of scaly lizard-type dinosaurs. I'm less a fan of the feather bird type dinosaur that we have now. They're still scary. Still scary. I wouldn't want to get pecked by a large chicken, put it that way. But there's just something scarier for me about a snake type dinosaur. So I don't like that they've all got feathers now. I don't like that we now know that they all had feathers, because it just seems like it was a big circus 65 million years ago. What are we talking about?
Eurobabes.
Oh, yes, please.
We're talking about Eurobabes. Zing,
zing, zing, zing.
We're talking
zing,
about... Zing.
Franco Potente.
Let's see if we can talk about Eurobabes and this stay in Franco Potente. I thought you were just saying that, like, oh no, yeah, you're talking about the actress Franco Potente.
Franco Potente.
Have you seen Run Lola Run?
No, I still haven't seen Run Lola Run. I don't think I have.
I rewatched that recently.
Yeah.
Stands up. That's the film. That's the German film that bust her out into the mainstream.
That's the one, huh?
She's fantastic in that. You know, she does a lot of running.
Right.
But there's just a great tradition, right, of the Euro babe.
Love the Euro babe.
Monica Bellucci.
Mm-hmm.
Audrey Tautou.
Mm-hmm. Other Euro babe type women.
Binoche. Juliet Binoche.
Oh, Juliet Binoche.
What other... So... Mila Jovovich.
Been no me likey, no thinky about Juliette Binoche. You know what I'm saying? Goodness me. What an actor. What a performer.
So you went straight to... I mean, I've called them Euro babes, but yeah, yeah. You went straight to smutty... But, you know, what do you want to say about Euro babes, even though it's my topic? It feels like you've got a lot to say.
What do I want to say about Euro babes?
Penelope Cruz. Uber Euro babe.
Uber Penelope Cruz. Now, Penelope Cruz almost feels as though she's crossed over, though. I feel like the definition of Euro babe requires for someone to remain niche and left field, for someone to remain Euro. Penelope Cruz is not, she's no longer Euro. She's Hollywood. She's pure Hollywood, okay? Plus, when they're Spanish, you're thinking a little bit of Mexican, who knows? You know what I'm saying? I know she's actually Spanish. I'm just saying she fits into Hollywood very, very neatly, and I think she's such a success that she's too large to be Euro, okay? She's crossed over from Euro. She's transcended Euro, and now she's just Hollywood.
Whoa.
What do you think the best moment in The Bourne Identity is? You quizzed me when you watched The Shawshank. You said, Adam, this is the best moment. This is the best shot of that whole movie, nay cinema. Mm. And then you told me what that was.
That's true. There was quite a lot of chatter about that on the Discord, by the way. There was a few
was
people... Yeah, there were a couple of people who had suggestions of other scenes. They agreed with me that scene was Hollywood, was cinema. But one of them said that the scene of the movie is the movie where Morgan Freeman finally changes his approach to his parole hearing.
That was my suggestion.
And also, there was someone who suggested what was the other scene that they suggested? I can't remember. There was another one in there. Anyway, the point is, there's a lot of great scenes in that film. I'm going to have a go at this. You've got a correct answer, I'm sure. Give me four moments. Allow me to suggest four. And I think I know which. I'm going to save the one I think is the best one for last. Okay, but I'm going to proffer others that people could suggest. The first great moment of the film is when Bourne shimmies down the side of the building. He's got his little orange, beige, brown jumper on. The music takes a delightful little turn. It's actually quite fun, you know? It's a little light relief. There's a tension release, which you often don't get in these sorts of films. And one of the things, it's an emblematic of one of the things I love about the movie, which is that Jason Bourne finds a lot of this stuff easy. It isn't constantly he's just narrowly escaping everything. You're watching someone who's perfectly at ease. There isn't a huge threat of him falling off the side of the building, and a lesser filmmaker would have the fear of him nearly slipping off the side of the cliff or whatever. No, he's going to shimmy down the building and be like a hero, because it's nothing to him. It's nothing to him. That's moment number one.
Can I say the score is fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
It's really underrated, the score.
Very good.
For Bourne. It's so good. And I'm not even talking about when, oh, baby.
No, no, no. You're talking about, yeah?
It's absolutely top notch.
Love it.
That's just because you're not, you don't know, it's not oppressive, but it's there, and it's this thrumming heartbeat of what you need. You're right. And also, I mean, within that sequence is when he sort of, the bag slips out of his hand and it just drops into the snow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then there's a little poof noise. Yeah.
It's like, that shouldn't have happened. There's a little, yeah. Damon's done some lovely little body acting. He's like, oh,
yeah, yeah.
That's annoying, because that's not part of his plan. And now he's going to have to do something else. Very subtle. That's a good shout for one of the greatest moments in the movie.
Here's another one. They arrive at his flat in Paris. They're outside in the car downstairs. Marie turns to Bourne and says, well, I guess this is goodbye. And he's scoping out the place. And he's saying, yeah, I guess it is. And she says, well, I could come up if you want, or I could just, you know, hang here. And he says, yeah, you could come up, or you could hang here. And she says, no, you'll forget about me if I stay down here. And he looks at her and he says, how could I forget about you? You're the only person I know. Lovely, lovely script line. Oh, and what I'm watching is Adam's taking his headphones off and he's looking around the room as though
something's happened. Sorry, I can hear some noise. Hang on a sec.
Have a listen. Yeah. Oh, he's very perplexed. Now, is it man looks out of windows, or is it man opens door to see if people want to come into room? Hard to know. Looks like a door to me.
They're fucking watching Ronin without me.
They're watching Ronin.
This is fucking Jesus Christ. Right, I'm going to
move.
Wow,
how upsetting for you. Why have you got to move?
You're going to hear the sound of car chases.
Okay, now you've found a new place to sit down, Adam. I'll remind you, I was just talking about that scene where he says, how could I forget you? You're the only person I know.
Yeah, that's quite nice. That's not the one. It's more like later on in the when they go up to the...
Wait. That's only moment number two. You're not saying okay. Another moment I haven't said yet, are you? Is it in his flat? Your moment is your moment in his flat?
Well, it's the moments later.
Yeah.
He hears a sound. He's walking around the flat. He's holding a knife. He's stalking the place. She's getting all steamy for a shower. And the movie's right. Making you think, she's going to get in the bath soon.
Right. Yeah.
And then they have an awkward moment. He doesn't want her to know he's got a knife, so he just drops it.
Yeah. That's a really lovely moment.
What's your third moment?
Well, can I just linger on that one for a moment? Because something I like about the moment you just referenced is the fact that the suggestion is that she's come upstairs because actually she's a little bit interested in having a bit of alone time with Jason Bourne. Okay, she's looking to continue this blossoming relationship, perhaps in a more physical medium. Mm-hmm. So I like this idea. She comes upstairs and everything looks fine. She looks around to see, again, this is all happening in the subtext. She's looking around. He's looking around to see, are there any killers in there? She's looking around to see, are there any family photos? Are there any photos of you with your wife? Oh, no family photos. This guy, he's single. Okay. Then she says, maybe I'll have a shower. Can I turn the... Now, we both know what that means, Adam. That means I've just been driving for 18 hours. I want to have sex, but I don't want to have sex in the dirty, flustered state I'm in. You know, let me have a shower. However, what happens? There's no hot water. And then they have a little moment, don't they, where they're standing opposite ends of doorways, looking at each other. Again, she doesn't realise, but he's looking around thinking, where's the bad guy coming from? Because he can sense that someone's coming in. But she's looking at him thinking, he's looking at me. Are we about to have sex? And what's happening in her mind? What's happening in her mind is, Do I need to have a shower? Do you know, like, could we just do it? Could we just go for it? Or you know, it's the weighing up of the hygiene versus the sort of the sexiness of the steamy situation. And I love that there are two completely different things going on for both the characters. And it's just terrific writing, the whole thing. It's fantastic. And the performances are fantastic as well.
I think he gives a few too many red flags away in that scene for her to be thinking, you know, oh, let's get down and dirty. She's like, are you all right? And he's staring at her like...
Maybe she just thinks he's nervous. Maybe she just thinks, oh, he's scared of sex. You know, he's like a big killer guy, but he's scared of vulnerability. Could be the case.
What's really good about the movie and the script in particular is that Gilroy manages to keep this the female character together with this hero, because at any point she should really leave, but at every single point the script gives you that moment where she could leave. And a lot of those kinds of movies, they just don't bother doing that work. You know, they just go, oh yeah, the Euro babe is going to stay with Vin Diesel because he's sexy and she probably wants to, or like she's got some
and
bullshit.
She's a shallow character that doesn't have any third dimension, so obviously she's just there.
So yeah, no, I really like that. So what's your third moment?
Okay, third moment is not long after that. They've just had they've beaten up that guy, the assassin, in the apartment. They've left, they're being chased by the police, they've had the car chase, and then they've hidden the car and they're hiding in a little hotel room somewhere, and he's dyeing her hair and he's washing her hair. I think there's something very sensual and close about washing someone else's hair. This happens just before their sex. Well, you know, there's not really a sex scene, but just before they have the characters have sex. Okay, and that feels like that's a kind of moment of choice that changes their relationship somewhat or strengthens it. You know, but there's something very sensual about the idea of washing somebody else's hair, the act of doing it, and I really love how the film captures that, because it leaves no requirement of a sex scene. You know, I think we've talked about this before, but sometimes sex scenes are left, often sex scenes are left in films when they really needn't be. Often all that you really need to know when you're watching a film is the characters had sex. Now, it's more a bit of information for you really than it is how they did it. Now, in some films, obviously, what happens during their sex is important to the story. Being able to see that sense of expression or how the characters are reacting to it is an important part of understanding the film. A lot of the time, it really isn't that important.
Yeah, you see, we've never talked about that. And you've revealed all you have to think about sex. We've never chatted about a sex scene, because I would always insist on a sex scene being in the movie.
We have chatted about that, haven't we?
No, I've never said, like, not.
Maybe I've chatted about it with my wife. What? So you think the sex scene should always be in the movie, or are you just doing a funny bit?
No, invariably, I kind of like that hair washing scene. I'm like, cut that and let's just have them having sex.
Cut the hair washing.
Yeah, because it's just...
It's dying. It's dying. He's dying her hair and cutting it.
It's done. Yeah, no, it's a nice scene and I get what you mean. But also part of me is also like, you're dancing around it.
Right.
We all want a little bit of sauce.
No more foreplay. Simply penetrate her. Is that what you mean? That's what you're talking about?
Yeah, no more foreplay. Just go straight to... You know, the women get to see Matt Damon's bottom... And his muscles.
Do they? Do we see bum? I didn't notice.
No, we don't. We don't get to see them.
Oh, we don't. Yeah, right? No, that's why I didn't notice it, because it's not there.
We could do that.
But how does it help the film? It
doesn't need to help the film. It just needs to help me. It just helped me enjoy. People like a little bit of sauce, a little bit of spice. But like, you're right. It's extra minutes. It is extra minutes to an overlong movie.
Or so only two, right? It's only 2 minutes.
Yeah, 30
seconds. 90 seconds, maybe. Yeah. All right. Moment number four. Then this is the moment. This is the real moment. We all know this is the moment. I wouldn't be that surprised if you think it's a different moment because of who you are. Well, it's actually a full scene. It's a full scene from when the children at the French farmhouse or whatever it is in the countryside are saying to their daddy in the background, "We can't find him. We can't find him." And Matt Damon says, Who can't they find? Oh, the dog. The dog. Oh, does the dog usually go missing? What, and miss breakfast? They say, "No." And then Matt Damon says, this is the line that really starts the scene. Matt Damon says, "Get in the basement." Yeah. And what follows is an explosion, him sort of gripping a shotgun like he's an American football player, just, you know, darting down the field. He runs past a tree. He chases Clive Owen. He uses birds to confuse his prey. And then, I mean, the whole scene is just magnificent. But what tops it off, not just the cherry on top, but actually, you know, it just steals the scene, is Clive Owen's performance of look at what they make you give. It's just magnificent. I absolutely love it. I love the whole. I love Matt Damon in the scene. I love how the scene is written. I love how Clive Owen approaches what his character is, the way he would talk, this idea that they would share something about the headaches. It's just magnificent, and it's where, for me, this is where the Bourne series is at its most alive and thriving. And they try and ish fail, you know, to a certain extent, to recreate that kind of magic in the second and the third film, because everybody who watches that scene goes, that's cinema magic right there.
Well, it wouldn't surprise you to know Doug Liman had to fight very, very hard for that sequence.
Really?
That's not... The studio didn't want that at all.
Wow.
So that's what... The reason why that magic, as you call it, wasn't... In it, actually, as you call it, as anyone calls it, it's a fucking great
it's
sequence.
It's magic, yeah.
It wasn't recreated is because no one else really had any interest in doing that. The person who did that left the series and went off to do other shitter things.
Well, I mean, I think... The way that they try to recreate versions of it in the second and the third film are having these assassins talk to each other and have these kind of discreet moments together, away from Treadstone or Blackbriar or you know, the powers that be, getting these people together, which does happen in, you know, there are moments of intimacy between them, which I think are, they feel like shadows, you know, shadows or reflections of what happens in the first film.
Well, you're underplaying the Bourne legacy, Renner and Oscar Isaac.
In the cabin. Yeah, I don't know, because it's not about vulnerability. It's all about suspicion. It's not like it's a completely different type of scene. That, you know, that look at what they make you give is a line that can only be uttered by a dying man. It's, there's nothing left. There's no competition here. There's no suspicion. It's only openness. It's total honesty, total vulnerability, and that cannot happen in the scenes with Oscar Isaacs and Jeremy Renner, because they are full of suspicion and they are shielding against each other always.
Yeah, no, but those scenes are really rich between those characters about how they would behave. It's a different flavour.
Different flavour for sure.
You like chocolate and I like vanilla.
Well, mine's right? More sort of Neapolitan in the sense that it's got all the flavours in it and it's the best one.
It's one flavour. Mm. It's Reese's one flavour.
I wouldn't say so.
Crybaby, the crybaby flavour.
Look at what they make you give.
And I'm after a little
bit. That's the moment though, right? That's the moment. That's the best moment of the film, right?
Yeah, sure.
Nailed it. Moving on. Hey, if you were recasting Bourne now, if they were making it now, because let me just set this up by saying, I think Matt Damon is the perfect Bourne, and a compliment that I would like to pay to Matt Damon, who failed to disappear into the role of Odysseus, is that Matt Damon, despite being Matt Damon, although he wasn't, you know, quote-unquote capital letters Matt Damon in 2002, he still was Matt Damon. He was Oscar winner Matt Damon. And he was young Boston kid Matt Damon, known to many. The reason I say all of this is because the compliment I would like to pay to Matt Damon is that I believe more than any other film that he's acted in, Matt Damon disappears into the role of Jason Bourne. When I watch the Bourne films, I don't see Matt Damon. I see Jason Bourne. And that's very hard for a movie star to achieve. I think it's the perfect character for Matt Damon's acting range. It doesn't require tons and tons of him. But what it takes, he does absolutely perfectly. He does it perfectly. And I see the character. I see the character. I think if Leonardo DiCaprio had played Jason Bourne, I wouldn't see Jason Bourne. I would see Leonardo DiCaprio, right? But Matt Damon, he's disappeared. Now, as I said, he didn't disappear into Odysseus. He doesn't disappear in many of the other Matt Damon films that we all know and love. He definitely doesn't disappear in The Martian. He doesn't disappear in The Adjustment Bureau. He disappears in Good Will Hunting, I would say, because he's so young at that stage.
But what do we mean by disappear?
I mean that when I'm watching the films, I completely see the character and I forget that, you know, it's being played by Matt Damon. I don't think about Matt Damon. I didn't watch The Bourne Identity tonight and think about The Odyssey. I watched and thought about Jason Bourne, the character. I fully bought into him.
Is that not the writing and the direction?
No, not all. I think a big chunk of it for sure. In the same way that, you know, you can't with directing and writing, you can't separate the success of a film, any element of the success, from those things. But performance is definitely important, and also context is important. You know, there are some people, movie stars, for whom it's very difficult to disappear into roles. For Leonardo DiCaprio, it's incredibly difficult because it's Leonardo DiCaprio. It's different to another actor.
Has Leo ever disappeared into a role for you?
I feel like Leo disappears in The Wolf of Wall Street, partly because I feel as though it suits his whole thing, his whole shtick, right? So, and also because the character is so much larger than life and a bit like a movie star in some senses, that it's easier to align these two visions that you have. But, you know, for all that I love Inception, for example, Leo doesn't disappear into that role. It's like Leonardo DiCaprio doing a terrific job and, like, making me believe it, and that's fine. Maybe he doesn't need to disappear. Maybe a movie star doesn't need to disappear often, and that's the role of an actor. I think Leo's done it maybe once or twice. For you, has he disappeared into any roles?
I think most, like, any of the movies I've watched and just really enjoyed, I guess ipso facto he has. Like, I really like The Aviator. I thought that was great, and so I'm like, well, and I'm not thinking, I don't know, maybe I don't know whether my surface mind is thinking this is Leo. Yeah. I mean, I know I'm watching a movie, but I'm swept away in it. I'm not thrown out by the fact that he's playing Howard Hughes. I think maybe our minds are different,
maybe.
But like, I watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I know I'm watching Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Sure.
I don't think ever for a minute.
No, same.
Think that they're characters.
I completely agree. But in a sense, like, that's a film that has movie stars in it, right? So it's like, I don't really mind that I'm watching those people because I enjoy watching those people. That's kind of what I mean. I don't think it has to diminish it. I think it's just a different experience.
I know. Sorry, I'm interrupting your game. But like, who is Bourne? What is Bourne? And does it matter? It's the same question. Like, what is Bond? Who is Bond?
Yeah.
Because it's going to impact my answer. Because you're going to go, who should be the modern Bourne?
Right, right, right. I am going to go there. But I think the interesting thing about Bourne, that's different to Bond, is that Bourne doesn't know who he is, and the audience don't either. So the character, the actor, kind of, you know, the character. Well, obviously, like the story gets to decide who he is, but to a certain extent, so does the actor, right? It's there in the text that this person is a bit of a blank canvas, and that we're all discovering them at the same time. So, whereas I would say that there are some preconceptions about James Bond that character wise would be there, mannerisms, for example, would be there regardless of who was playing them. I think you can get away with a little bit more with Matt Damon. I think what's important is that you're able to play, is that the person who plays the role is able to sort of project. What Matt Damon does very, very well in this film is project confusion instantly covered up by security. Do you know what I mean? You see flashes of what the hell's happening, but then total security as something then happens. Give me Baby Bourne. I want Baby Bourne.
No, okay, but before I do Baby Bourne, I would say, you know, you're sort of saying, oh, we know that Bourne's a blank. Bourne is a blank, but then also very, very quickly he reveals himself to be a boring baby because he is a character who insists on discovering that he's a good person. Throughout the first movie and definitely the subsequent ones, he has to pay a price. He was a horrible murderer, killer. And then the whole thing is this American lie that you can reimagine yourself and you can suddenly wash away the past by just doing good things. If I'm suddenly a good guy and I do good, I'm a good person. And James Bond, you know, was written and conceived as an anti-Bond. Like, Bond is this so, like, silly character. We need to do this American. Why can't we do this American character? Mm. It's more modern and it's better and it's more interesting.
Yeah.
But Bourne is just this boring goody two shoes, and his character is he'll only do the good right thing. And Bond is as he should be, always this slightly edgier, horrible character. He manipulates women. He is, you know, he'll do the worst things. Not a good guy, a bad guy.
Yeah, but I don't like.
And so,
listen, man, you were on a really good run there for a second. You were on a good run there for a second. But I think what you're coming
up
against.
It was fun, wasn't it?
It was really fun. It was really fun. What you're coming up against is, I think, post-modernity. I believe that Daniel Craig's James Bond is everything that you've just described Bourne to be. So I don't think that a James Bond movie has been made in the 21st century that isn't a version of Bond, you know, maybe not trying to discover it for himself, but the film trying to express that Bond actually is quite a good person, and for why we should feel sorry for him because of his backstory, and why he's actually, you know, a pretty darn good guy despite all these horrible things he does. So maybe you could argue that it's been Americanized. I think I would just argue that it's a product of its time. Which is one of a time of nuance.
No, it's wonderful. You've helped me argue my point. Your Bond has been Americanized and it's been infected by modernity. Bond was this horrible, vicious, sexist, misogynist.
But wasn't he only? Twat. Isn't he only that through the eyes of modern audiences? Like, you know, I don't think people were going to watch the Sean Connery films and going like, "Oh, I love what a dickhead he is." I think they all thought, like, broadly speaking, that it was kind of good for him to shag all the birds, right? I think we watch it now and go, hey, Bond, this just isn't on, man. But back in the day, they were being made like in all seriousness in that way. So I think your argument doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. No, the tech, I'm talking about the books. I'm talking about the original books.
I haven't read any of the books.
I think you can still have that kind of character that doesn't need to be such a, I need to do the right thing, I need to be always good in this boring Bourne way, you know.
Right.
The bored identity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like it when characters don't explore their interior at all and when they just do things and don't think about it. I agree.
But no, Bourne doesn't do that. He has no memory of anything, and he just decides. It's the idea that you can wake up as a baby and you would just do the good thing. It's stolen from Total Recall. The whole thing is Total Recall.
baby Bourne.
Okay, let's do Baby Bourne.
Got to be an American. It's got to be an American.
Oh, what?
It's got to be an American.
No,
of course he does, because you just got finished saying Bourne is like. Is the American anti-Bond, okay? You can't cast an English Bourne.
Of course you can, because Americans have played Englishmen, and I'm going to say an Englishman who's played Americans.
Harris Dickinson.
Daniel Kaluuya.
Oh, I see what you've done. I see what you've done.
I just want to say my favourite actor.
I see what you've done there. Okay, you've picked an English actor, but you've picked one that I can't argue with because he's so good.
He's phenomenal. He's not in enough stuff. He's got the physical presence for it. He's got the vibe for it.
He's got the American chops. I'll give you that. He can do American for sure. And the character's American, right?
Yeah, and he plays great American. Get Out. Yeah. Widows he pops up in.
Right.
Anyone else is just, I think, is just too big an actor. Like Damon, you keep saying Damon was his big name. He wasn't big, Boffo.
I wasn't saying that.
No, I know,
God,
but like
you
not
love
big.
Playing words in my mouth.
Sorry. Look, my wife says the same thing. I don't mean to, but like, say for example, I'll say names that are too big.
Okay, too big.
Robert Pattinson, too big. No. Jack O'Connell, too big. Aaron Taylor Johnson, too big.
Jack O'Connell, I revisit Jack O'Connell. He's not too big.
He's far too big.
Jack O'Connell.
He's not even American, and you have an issue with that, right?
I know, but listen, you've just broken my back on Americans. Now I'm thinking, huh, maybe. But listen, you're asking me if I could see someone from Skins playing Bourne. Maybe I could. Well, what about Dev Patel? Could we have Dev Patel? I'd recast Dev Patel in literally anything. You know, I rewatched The Green Knight the other day, and it is just fantastic.
Yeah, no, he doesn't count in any of our games because we just say him, which is fine.
Yeah.
Well, what about Taron Egerton?
Nah. He's too Elton John.
Nicholas Holt.
No.
Why?
He hasn't got it. He hasn't got the chops. He's not got the chops.
Wrong.
No, Robert Pattinson doesn't have the chops either. I'm sorry. Get the spear. Pick up the spear. Oh, look, there's another spear.
Jeremy Allen White.
Yeah, maybe if we wanted Bourne to be have a little bit of a boss about him, a little bit Brucey Bourne. I like that. He's like Brucey the boss by day, and then by night he's Bourne. I'm on board with that. You know, he could fight, but it would only be allowed to fight in a kitchen where he could really deal with the pressure. You know,
and he said like anytime he sneaks up behind a baddie, he goes behind, and then he chops off someone's hands, and he goes hands, and everyone laughs.
Do you know what? That I haven't laughed at that, and I'll admit that I haven't laughed. But that's one of the funniest things you've ever said, right there. That's not one of the funniest things. It's one of the cleverest things. It's one of the cleverest little funnies. That's what it is. It's one of the cleverest little funnies you've ever done, I would say. Coming up behind someone and then shouting behind. That's very... And I didn't laugh at it. Because in a sense, it's not really that funny, but it's just so clever a funny. Do you know what I mean? It's a very clever little funny.
Because I've had to say behind to say the joke. He doesn't really... land if you have to
right. No, I think that's it.
He snuck up in the vicinity of a baddie and said behind
kind
of thing.
Yeah, terrific. Who else you got?
I mean, that's it really. There's no one else knocking around. Alden Elric.
What if they gave it to Paul Dano? Imagine Paul Dano's born.
I mean, no, I don't want to.
Fair enough.
Bonjour. Nice sweater. Nice sweater.
You like, nay, love the Bourne Identity. You gave it 94 out of 100.
Yeah.
I do not consider you a fan of this kind of caper.
Right.
For example, if someone said to me, I loved the Bourne Identity. Have you got any suggestions for other movies that I'd like? I like the Bourne Identity, I'd say, ho, ho, ho. Oh, have I got a list for you? 3 Days of the Condor. Ronin, you know, I'd say this kind of thing,
right?
But I've never recommended those movies to you because I just don't believe. I don't know. There's some kind of switch in your brain where you've decided this one's acceptable to like.
No.
But generally, this kind of caper is not your cup of tea.
Couple of things to say. The first is there's actually 3 things to say. The first thing is, I might have been 11 when this film came out. So I saw this for the first time at a very impressionable young age. I didn't see it in the cinema. I would have seen it on video or DVD or something, right? And I thought it was fantastic. In the same way that, you know, when I saw The Matrix for the first time, that made a real impression on me. The second thing to say is that whether or not you agree with me is irrelevant. I believe that The Bourne Identity is a truly transcendent film. I feel it transcends genre on the basis of its quality. And therefore, my interest in it and my liking of it, it has a limited amount to do with the action involved or the sort of film that you might assign it to, the sort of genre that we might decide to assign it to. And then the third reason, I think about this as like, American movies made in Europe are cool, man. Like, that's a genre I'm into. I like the sort of false romance that they portray. I like the simplicity that they suggest. It makes me feel better about the place I live, even though what I'm watching is a fantasy, you know? There's something sweet and nice and fantastical about it. There's something recognizable, and yet there's something different. And so, for me, I would just as easily assign The Bourne Identity, or indeed many of the other Bournes. In fact, I would argue that the least interesting bits of the second and third Bournes are when they're in the US. I think those scenes are boring. You know, the New York scenes where they're walking around the block. Hey, meet me down the block, Pam Landy. You know, I mean, listen, if Pam Landy was in the Bourne, that'd make it even better. Love a bit of Pam Landy. Love a bit of Noah Chestnut. Love them. I'm big fans of all of their work. I don't like how they pound the pee outside in New York. It's just boring to me. Those scenes are boring. Yet Morocco, wow, fantastic.
It's just hard. If you go, oh, no, this movie is elevated and it's because I love it because of this, this and this. I can't then say, watch 3 Days of the Condor, watch Parallax View, watch Ronin, you know, watch Day of the Jackal. Because I don't know if you'll like them because you seem to think you're above genre.
I watched Day of the Jackal. We watched Day of the Jackal, didn't we?
Not together.
No, but like as in we both watched it around the same time. Do you not remember?
No.
The Jackal. Is it The Jackal?
No, Day of the Jackal. There's a remake with Bruce Willis.
So The Jackal isn't the same as Day of the Jackal?
No.
Hmm.
I would never have told you to watch The Jackal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Jackal's the one where Jack Black gets his arm blown off.
Yes.
Right. I didn't think that was very good.
No, it's rubbish. Should we do the box office game?
I'd bloody love to do the box office game. My favourite part of the podcast, Adam Richmondo, as I think you well know. Now, brackets estimated budget, please, por favor, for The Bourne Identity, which of course, as you know, came out June the 16th, 2002.
Well, I know the budget spiralled because old Dougie Lyman, he insisted on shooting actual locations.
Right. Yeah.
Testament to Lyman. Although, did you spot when you rewatched it, there's two scenes that have got the worst green screen backdrop of it, like, ever.
Oh, I'm not sure I did spot. What were they?
There's an early insert cut between Chris Cooper and Brian Cox where they're having a chat, ostensibly in some sort of CIA office, but they've obviously, they want to give it some scale, and they've given it, like, there's a big back. There's a big room.
I didn't notice that.
And you can see the blue screen of it. And then it happens again with those guys. It happens at the end when Cox is talking to the Senate committee or whatever the fuck.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's the reverse on him. And behind him is like this, he's a blue screen behind him. And they've just given all these chairs. It looks, the scenes smack of like panic, of like the audience don't understand what's going on.
Right.
Because things have changed. And it's quite a complicated plot. And like, we need to tell the audience, you know, who the baddies are. I get that. Anyway, it's quite funny. Like, you know, the film, it's so much of it is like clearly shot on location in these European cities.
Yeah.
So as a result, I would say they would probably only want to spend 50, 60 mil, but Doug Lyman punched them up to $75 million.
They spent $60 million, estimated.
Oh.
So pretty close. Not close enough, but pretty close. And actually, I think an impressive movie for $60 million in 2002. What do you think? Real and textured, isn't it?
Yeah, and Damon's not asking for loads of money. He can't demand that kind of gubbins.
Sure. No, absolutely.
But I think
not.
If Lyman hadn't have been such a, you know, whatever he was, it probably would have come in at more like 45, 50 mil, maybe.
Okay.
Because it wasn't a slam dunk, you know. Matt Damon's not an action star. I don't know if you know this. Hello, Joe. I don't know if you know this.
What?
Hello. Matt Damon was not known as an action star.
I did not know that.
The studios, they don't know if they can sell this guy.
They're taking a punt. Opening weekend US and Canada, June 16th, 2002. What do we think a little movie like this is taking for opening weekend?
Well, I reckon it's going to make a surprising amount of money.
Okay. Surprisingly high, surprisingly low, surprisingly middle. Everyone was expecting high or low, and it was middle.
Well, I think people were expecting nothing. The scuttlebutt was down on this flick.
Really?
Yeah. Ooh. 2002, you know, Lyman, no one's like, what is this flick?
9/11 just happened.
Hello? Is this 9/11? Yeah. Well, we've just ruined your chances for opening a movie.
Right.
Ironically, I think this would have helped, old 9/11.
Maybe it would have. Who could say?
Yeah, well, I think
I can't read into the American zeitgeist at the time. I don't know what's the.
I can't believe we've not talked about 9/11. This is a year after 9/11, and you've not talked about.
Yeah.
This is such a post 9/11 movie. It doesn't smack me as a post 9/11 movie.
Well, they would have been making it before 9/11, so it's not. It falls into that. You know, all of the thoughtful work happened earlier. So I don't think it counts. You know, a true post 9/11 movie doesn't emerge until 2003.
Great.
Anyway, what do you think this made on opening weekend?
Doug Liman, he directed Jumper. He knows about Jumper territory.
Oh yeah. How does he open? What is Jumper territory?
Well, it's 25 to 30.
Sure, sure. But what was Jumper?
Jumper. Yeah. But that was like 27.
It was 27, yeah, yeah. How does Doug Liman open, Adam?
Well, he opens 25 to 30, and I'd say this is 25.
27, my friend. It is Jumper. It's not Jumper territory. It's Jumper open. Huh?
That's so nice. But I'm in within the 10%.
Of course, yeah. A little helping hand, but no, I think you were getting there on your own anyway.
Excuse me? Excuse me?
Now, gross worldwide. The Bourne Identity. Gross worldwide. What are we thinking? Is it the little film that could? Is it the little film that should?
Oh, this runs and runs. This performs, overperforms.
Sure. Well,
oh,
does
like
it?
You wouldn't believe.
Does it?
Oh, it does. It does.
Okay.
But maybe it also does on DVD. Ooh, I think it does. Just such a fucking bell end. Joe's 10% rule would have you think that this movie made 270 mil. And it's exactly that kind of flick. But I would personally believe, based on the critical response and the audience response and the... if the 10% rule were to be believed, it's going to overperform to 270 mil. And also to get sequels, well, at least one sequel. So, you know, playing by those rules, and if I'm wrong, then it makes a mockery of the 10% rule.
You've really found a way to needle, haven't you? You've really found a little needle, Richmond needle here. Now, the question is, do you care enough to be deliberately wrong? That's the real question.
I do think it would overperform, and I would say... It gets something to the tune of, say, 310 mil.
Well, it gives me no pleasure to tell you that it did not overperform. It underperformed.
Oh dear!
It made $214 million.
That's under.
Yeah.
The 10x. That's confusing, isn't it? Very confusing.
It's not. It isn't. I think I'll put some thought into what the reason for this is.
I'm going to take some needle out. Mm. I find this very interesting.
Okay.
How could this have happened?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
I don't really know either, to be honest. You would have thought it would not be this kind of anomaly.
It was very well received.
Yeah, and it's a really good film and people liked it. So, I don't really understand what happened. I mean, I'm looking at the numbers for Supremacy and for Ultimatum. So, it got sequels. So
the sequels probably must have come off the back of hot DVD sales.
Well, I mean the sequel, the second one came out in 2004, right? So, like, they were making it before the DVD sales had sold well, I would say. The budget for that was $75 million estimated. It did $52 million on opening weekend, but it grossed $292 million. So again, that doesn't quite mesh with the 10x rule.
But these are big profits, aren't they?
Sure, they're big profits. But it's not. I'm more concerned for my rule. That's all.
I think maybe the Bourne movies, maybe they are this anomaly. Like they do, they've both made money. They're going to continue to make money on DVD and then just on TV. They're on TV all the time.
Well, and they grew because the third one, the budget was $110 million and it did $70 on opening weekend and it made $442. So, you know, that's real pace. That's really growing. That's at the scale where the 10x rule doesn't really apply anyway.
And that's people who didn't go to see Identity or Supremacy at the cinema,
yeah,
but have watched it on ITV two,
yeah,
or whatever, and then gone, oh yeah, no, I've got to see this now. I've got to see the third one. Late to the party.
Yeah.
And then everyone turns up. But it's like why Skyfall makes like $1 billion or however much. It's like,
right,
where
because
have
the
you
other
come
ones
from?
Happen first. Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. Strange.
Well, interesting. Wow. Joe's face, guys. If you could see Joe's face right now, you would. This is a picture. He does not know, and I don't know. You know what to do with it. I feel like if I say the wrong thing, he's going to
make the sound that my face suggests.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy.
Should we do the bit of the show where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot with a view to catching out the other one on a list of movies they forgot to do the show, do the episode?
Oh, so close. You made it so close. You nearly got it. One of these days you'll get there.
One of these days,
I believe in you. I believe in you. The thing is, though, I just don't know whose go it is anymore.
It's my go.
Is it your go? Great. Okay. Good.
Because there's no way in a million years you would have let me get you on the Bourne Identity.
No, that's true. Okay, hit me.
Juno.
No. I don't want to watch it.
Okay. But you don't think of it, right?
It's plum. Yeah, it's real plum. It's culturally plum, though, and I would say it's like considered culturally plum. I don't think it's like a sweet pull. I think everyone knows that Juno's culturally plum. People talk about it as a sort of forgotten movie. You know, it's not like it's not like a golden handshake sort of situation. I'm saying, yeah, it's plum, yeah, it's plum. But, you know, I think any guy could have walked in here and said Juno, so it's not a special plum. Okay. But it's plum.
Okay, well, that's really, really rude.
Not anyone could have walked in here.
Amelie.
I've never seen Amelie. I've managed to avoid watching Amelie because I think I will not like it.
I think you'd really like it.
That's very rude, man. Come on. I know I was rude to you a second ago, but now you're just being rude to me.
I think time enough has passed, and if I don't get you on 5, you should volunteer to do Amelie.
Okay, fine. I'll agree to that. I agree to that.
Oh dear, you're not gonna like any of these. Misery.
What with older Kathy
Bates?
No, I'm not watching Misery. Fuck, man, that's just Christ alive. What where she kidnaps the author?
Yeah.
Nah, I can't watch it. It's boring.
Scared.
I've seen it. I watched it. I was just bored by it.
Bristol Wife. She was talking about. The children, the tweens, who you know, the word boring has floated around quite a lot from the 11 to 13 year olds. Boring.
Yeah.
When an adult says something, and the one of them said boring and then disappeared, and I wasn't stung, but I was like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe the thing I said was boring,
right?
And she said very wisely, these kids, boring can mean many things. It can mean I'm scared, it's too much for me, I'm overwhelmed, I'm scared, I'm a big baby, I've wet my pants. So when you say you're bored, what you really mean is,
yeah,
it's too overwhelming.
I was overwhelmed because, I wanted to be kidnapped by Kathy Bates.
Volvere.
It's too good.
When have you thought of it? I haven't thought of that.
I mean,
movie.
We talked about it today. Once. And I feel like the DVD cover, the poster, very famous. I don't know. I'll get you on it if you want at some point. But
totally forgotten it.
Right. Okay.
Fantastic movie, but
very good. Very good. Yeah.
La Haine.
Now there's a movie I've been meaning to rewatch. Let's do La Haine. I'm all up for La Haine.
There we go.
I've been trying to get my wife to watch La Haine for ages, and I think it's good because it's so short. It's 94 minutes long, okay? And I keep seeing it on the streamers. It's on BFI Player. And I keep saying to my wife, hey, let's watch La Haine. And she says, what's La Haine? Oh, no, I'm scared. It looks bleak. And I go, no, don't let the black and white terrifying young Frenchman put you off. It's fine. it's fine, Lehen's fine. And she says, what's it about? And I say, well, it's about horrible, the horrible life of these young men.
But it's so vibrant. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. I know it's a phenomenal movie. I'm worried now.
Right.
My mind is addled and I'm not able to still see it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're worried that Lehen won't be a 10 for you anymore because you're too old.
Yeah. I've got it on Blu-ray. Haven't watched it, but I've got it on Blu-ray waiting for me to watch it.
All right, great. Lehen. Let's do it. And then we can show up to next week's episode and go... because of hens. You
know? Right, we can really lay an egg.
Yeah. And we can crack that egg and take home a little case of Slimonella. No, that doesn't really work.
Maybe we should pour some gravy over Lehen.
Ah, right. Well, no, I'm a vegetarian, so instead I think I could just let Lehen free range itself to death at a ripe old age.